it just left click?
It just left click.
Okay.
Good morning, everyone. I want to thank you also for coming out this early. Probably be nicer to be out on the water having breakfast, and you chose to be here, and we appreciate it. The title of my talk today is Coverage is Not Enough, Lessons from the Covering Kids and Families Access Initiative. And I'm excited to have this chance to share with you some information about this less known but quite compelling component of CKF. Before I go any further, I want to acknowledge my co-authors. Louise Palmer and Bridget Courteau both worked closely with me on this project and just recently moved on to bigger and better things. Also want to, of course, thank our funders, who are the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation. Robert Wood Johnson funded the larger Covering Kids and Families evaluation, which was done through a contract with Mathematica Policy Research, and then subcontracts with the Urban Institute and a group called Health Management Associates. So it is their support that is allowing us to do this study. My talk today is organized into four or five sections. I'm going to give you a little bit of background about the Covering Kids and Families Access Initiative and how it fits within the broader CKF program. I'm then going to talk briefly about some prior work that's been done in this area and how it's set a baseline for us to do our case study work. I'm going to spend the majority of my time talking about our case study findings, and then I'll finish up with some cross-cutting lessons learned and discussion of the findings for future policy, the implications. Many of you have probably heard of Covering Kids, the Covering Kids Initiative, which was then followed by the Covering Kids and Families Initiative. CKF was a four-year, $55 million initiative funded by RWJ that put grants out to the states, 45 of the 50 states, and then 140 localities within those states, all in support of the efforts to do outreach and enrollment of kids who are eligible for CHIP and Medicaid. The whole design of CKF was really pointed at outreach, simplification of eligibility rules and procedures, and coordination of CHIP with Medicaid and other public health coverage programs. The CKF Access Initiative was a complementary activity that was layered on top of CKF, a two-year initiative, $4 million. It grew out of the fact that CKF, again, its rules were quite strict in terms of how grantees could spend their time and their resources, and again, it was all focused on getting kids enrolled. Grantees were specifically prohibited from helping those families, once enrolled, with accessing care, and many grantees found that quite frustrating. We had done a series of case studies under this broader CKF evaluation and heard that message over and over again. So the Access Initiative grew from that, was specifically put in place to allow grantees to turn that corner and focus on access issues with their enrolled families. In all, 18 Access Initiative grants were made to local grantees, local CKF grantees, again, $4 million, 2 years. The structure of the grants had some rules. Grantees during a phase one period were supposed to conduct assessments in their community to identify the range of access barriers that were presenting for families. And then in the second phase, they were supposed to adopt and implement one or more strategies to try to address those access barriers. At the same time, they were encouraged to collect data, evaluate their efforts, and search for sustainable ongoing funding. So it was quite a large charge for a two-year grant period. It's important to note that there has been some initial assessment work of the Access Initiative grantees. Carolyn Needleman of Bryn Mawr University conducted two rounds of telephone interviews with the lead person in each grantee organization. Those calls were made in 06 and 07. The first round primarily focused on early implementation experiences. The second round primarily focused on sustainability issues. And you can find reports and papers from that work at www.rwjf.org. I'm going to focus the rest of our discussion, on the case studies that followed these telephone interviews. We actually listened in and participated on a good number of the telephone interviews that Carolyn conducted. And from the information gathered there, we picked five states to do follow-up in-depth case studies of. What we wanted to do through case studies was really develop a deeper understanding of how the grantees identified barriers to access, what strategies they developed to address those barriers, how those strategies were implemented, what barriers did they confront during implementation, and then what effects, if any, were measured from their work. We designed our case study approach that put us on site for about 3 days for every grantee. We conducted numerous interviews with stakeholders, not just the grantee staff, but also state partners, providers, advocates, and others in the community to try to obtain multiple perspectives on how these initiatives were going. All of the work was conducted and finished about a year ago, and so we're in the process of finalizing our report. Here's a map that identifies the states where the grantees resided. There were, again, 18 states that received grants. The yellow states show you where we conducted our case studies. We conducted the studies in Connecticut, Maryland, Minnesota, North Carolina, and Washington. We chose these five for a number of reasons, but primarily we chose them because they were quite effective in our view of or they appeared to be at least at face value, quite effective in addressing access barriers. We also selected them because they presented a real range and diversity of access barriers and strategies to confront them. We also chose them because we thought they provided the greatest potential for rendering lessons that others could learn from, whether at the state or local level. That said, let me go ahead and move on with our findings from the case studies. I don't have time to go through all five, but I did upload all five slides in case you're downloading information and want to learn about all five. I'll talk about three of the five, though, this morning. The first grantee was in the state of Connecticut in Bridgeport, the Bridgeport Children's Advocacy Coalition. It's a group that has had a long-standing community action sort of perspective focused on child health and behavioral health. BCAC worked with a number of partners, but an advocacy group called Connecticut Voices for Children served as their primary state partner. The grantee assessed its community needs through multiple methods. They conducted focus groups with families and providers. They conducted telephone interviews with pediatricians, and they did surveys with pharmacists. And from this effort, the grantee chose to focus its project on the problem of pharmacy access for children enrolled in Connecticut's Medicaid program, which is called Husky A. Husky A is a managed care model. All children are enrolled in managed care. And they focused in on pharmacy access because it was the most commonly identified barrier that families had, or it was commonly identified that families had trouble filling prescriptions for their children for non-formulary drugs, that is, drugs not on the formulary of the health plan, or drugs for which they did not have prior authorization. Providers said they had problems understanding Medicaid rules and regs surrounding non-formulary drugs. Pharmacists reported problems troubleshooting with families how to get through and around prior authorization denials. Fundamentally, pharmacists were not aware of the fact that Medicaid policy was in place that would allow pharmacies to dispense 30-day supplies of drugs in emergency situations without prior authorization, and there was a real lack of awareness of that policy. So what BCAC did was quite straightforward. They wanted to try to fix this access problem by providing user-friendly educational materials to all three of those targets, families, providers, and pharmacists. For families, they developed a brightly colored brochure and flyer outlining what to do if pharmacies don't fill a prescription. They got that flyer out to 30,000 families. For pharmacists, they develop another flyer that outlines steps to take for dispensing non-formulary and prior authorization required prescriptions, and those all had to differ based on the four managed care plans participating in Husky. The flyer was distributed to all 650 participating pharmacists in the state, and for providers, they developed a toolkit that allowed pediatric office managers to better understand Husky policies and procedures, and there was a specific piece on pharmacy access. The state partner, meanwhile, worked at the state level with the Medicaid agency to develop recommendations for how the state could provide stronger oversight of its contracts with managed care plans related to pharmacy benefits. The grantee in Connecticut did not have time to do a formal evaluation of its work, but they did conduct a second round of focus groups with families, pretty much replicating what they had done during the assessment phase. And sure enough, pharmacy issues were no longer on the radar in terms of access problems that these families talked about. So they took that as a good indicator of success. Turning to Minnesota, one of the grantees we visited was actually in Olmsted County, which is where Rochester is. Olmsted County Community Services and its Family Services and Assistance Agency was the grantee. They're the agency that administers such programs as food stamps, child support, child care, and cash assistance. The context for this effort was that Rochester, over the years, had become a magnet of sorts for a broad range of immigrant populations. Started around the Mayo Clinic and that as a draw, and for a variety of other reasons. Olmsted County partnered with Minnesota Children's Defense Fund as their state partner, and with a local group called the Intercultural Mutual Assistance Association, which was a non-for-profit group that provides assistance to immigrants and provides a range of culturally appropriate support services. They did the most formal assessment of any grantee in the project. They spent basically three quarters of their grant period developing and then conducting a survey of 220 residents, 83% of whom were immigrants, 80% were families with children. They identified as a leading barrier for immigrants problems with health plan and provider selection, and then subsequent problems with communicating with providers. What they developed in Olmsted County was a community health worker program. They used the grant to train a cadre of community health workers. These workers visited families in their homes, worked with them to untangle paperwork problems, interpret health plan guidance, and assisted these families with selecting health plans and providers. The CHW staff had an impressive array of skills representing Somali, Sudanese, Vietnamese, Cambodian, Bosnian, and Latino cultures and languages. At the same time, the Children's Defense Fund worked at the state level to develop what they called a paperwork matrix that identified redundant and confusing paperwork that was being issued by the state and by health plans. As far as effects go, over 500 clients were served, over 1,000 home visits were conducted between 03 and 05. Based on the perceived effects of this model, effectiveness, the county and IMAA worked with educators to develop and implement a community health worker curriculum in local community colleges. And this grantee was quite successful in obtaining sustainability funding. At the state level, the CDF worked with the Medicaid agency to actually pass legislation that will allow Medicaid reimbursement for community health worker services provided to Medicaid enrollees. The final grantee that I'll talk about today is in Buncombe County, which is in the Asheville area of North Carolina, Buncombe County Department of Social Services. They work primarily with the Buncombe County Medical Society, which is a physician membership organization, and during their identification phase conducted open-ended interviews with parents and providers. The primary finding of their work was that language barriers were really hurting some families' ability to access care for their kids. Specifically, the only providers with capacity to provide interpretation services for limited English proficiency families were the county health departments. And the county health departments were over capacity. They'd refer these families on to other providers who didn't have interpreters. The families found they couldn't communicate with these folks, and so they ended up in the ER. So it was a real bad sort of situation. Plus, no one was aware of the federal rules that require any agency that receives federal funding to provide language assistance. So the interventions there in North Carolina were to develop an interpreter network. They worked very closely with the medical society. They found interpreters in the community, organized them, recruited more, developed a training curriculum, and in the end formed an organization called WIN, the Western North Carolina Interpreter Network, which included 40 interpreters with capacity in 11 different languages. DSS also worked closely with providers to teach them about the federal title. Is it Title IV or Title VI? I wrote down both, and I'm not sure which it is. Excuse me. Anyway, WIN continues to be in place in the Buncombe County Medical Society. Between 2005 and 2007, over 750 patients were helped with interpreter services by WIN. I am going to hop over findings from Maryland and Washington State. Suffice to say that Maryland helped pregnant immigrant women access prenatal care, and Washington developed a care coordination program for persons who were overusing the emergency department. Let me just hit the lessons learned real quick in my last minutes here. Essentially, we found that the most effective grantees were those who had a long history of working in their communities. They weren't new at this stuff, and they really were well plugged in into their communities. The grantees gained a great deal of experience both conducting the needs assessments and learning multiple methods for a needs assessment, and also being kind of surprised at what they found. Many times what they learned from their assessments were not what they expected. They assumed that there were access problems that really weren't present in their community, and they learned what was really going on for families. Targeting grants to the local level was a good strategy for RWJ. It allowed community-based organizations to develop homegrown solutions. And the more narrowly and discreetly focused a grantee was on an access barrier, the more chance they seemed to have of success. Grantees had good things to say about the structure and flexibility of the grant. These are props to RWJ. The flexibility was applauded. The technical assistance from the National Program Office, which was the Center for Healthcare Strategies in Princeton, was widely praised. They all basically said, though, that you needed more than 2 years to get all this done. A longer time frame would have permitted more complete implementation, better data collection, and better fundraising for sustainability. Sustainability was challenging for everyone, even the successful projects. It was more likely to occur if they planned for it from the get-go, when there were low-cost interventions and cost savings that tended to be associated with better sustainability. And so in closing, let me just say that many evaluations over the years have shown us how important insurance coverage is, that getting kids covered is a critical first step in improving their health status and their access to care. But I think the Access Initiative has taught us a few things about how important it is to also address the myriad access barriers that these families face often once they do obtain insurance. And I think that this evaluation of the Access Initiative really provided us with some good, vivid examples of targeted strategies and show how outreach and enrollment efforts coupled with Access Initiative improvement strategies can really make a difference. So, thanks very much, everyone.
Thank you.